Today's program was brought to you by Itoen, the leading green tea company and makers of Oi Ocha, Japan's number one selling green tea. For more information, visit itoen.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Conspicuous consumption and lavish dinner parties of excess marked the Gilded Age. But what did the ordinary people eat? We'll find out today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And we know a lot about the America's Gilded Age, primarily through novels and stories and paintings and accounts of all their lavish dinner parties. It was an age of conspicuous consumption, for sure. But what did the ordinary people eat? We know about the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers and all the robber barons and industry tycoons. It was a culture then of such consumption. And of course, same thing happened that we know about from the era of royal courts and the Renaissance ages. We know what was eaten in the courts. We know what was eaten at the lavish banquets. Food of ordinary people is an area that has been understudied, underlooked, well, primarily because there weren't a lot of documentation. There isn't a lot of documentation on that period, except for a lot of nutritional anthropology. Not a lot, but some nutritional anthropology from the periods. But Robert Dirks, the author of Food in the Gilded Age, he has done quite an extensive study into the Gilded Age. And he poses the question about what ordinary people ate and discovers some surprising answers by peering through the lens of what was then a newly emerging science of nutrition. Robert Dirks, a member of Chicago Foodways Roundtable, grew up in suburban Milwaukee, and he earned a PhD in anthropology at Case Western University, and he joined the faculty at Illinois State University. He retired from there a few years ago and gladly has been spending his time writing about much of this study that he has been doing. He's conducted research on various aspects of food and nutrition worldwide, and his publications have appeared in a lot of scholarly journals on anthropology and nutrition. And his previous book, Come and Get It, McDonaldization and the Disappearance of Local Food from a Central Illinois Community, traced a changing American food culture from frontier days to the beginning of the 21st century. And now he has put that same small and focused lens to work in his most recent book called Food in the Gilded Age, What Ordinary Americans Ate. Welcome, Robert.
Well, thank you, Linda. Very nice to be with you this morning.
It says that you have really changed what we know about the 19th century, the end of the 19th century, about science and nutrition, and also about the ordinary people. Certainly, we have a lot of books that document it. Jacob Riis, of course, doing a lot of his tenement photographic series and books that were written talking mostly about the other side, the lavish side, but very little written about the habits, particularly eating habits of that era. Can you describe for our listeners exactly, when you say the Gilded Age, what period were you talking about? How many decades were you looking at?
Okay, that's a very good place to start. The Gilded Age, in historians' understanding, usually begins some years after the Civil War, let's say around 1870, through the turn of the century, maybe a few years beyond that. Let's say 1900, and it's a time of immense economic growth in the United States. But shall we say the top 1%?
Right. Gee, funny how things haven't changed.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this, you know, this Gilded Age was a time, obviously, you know, of strong economic growth, and as I mentioned, you know, the robber barons of note and industry tycoons. Well, the Industrial Revolution was coming. So, but there were so many promises that came with it. And of course, those promises often fell through, especially with the great waves of immigration. So when you say ordinary Americans, who were these people? Who were the ordinary Americans that you're talking about?
Well, a whole range of them. My book basically surveys the country as we knew it nutritionally around 1900 or so, and the areas of that we know about for that period are the parts of the Northeast and the Southeast and the Mid-Atlantic states, some of the upland or Appalachian South, the Black Belt of Alabama and Mississippi, the Midwest, and parts of the West, particularly New Mexico and California. So there, within that area, we've able to look at African Americans, working class communities, very impoverished communities, and a whole variety of immigrants.
And it's interesting because so much of that population that again has come into our awareness primarily were, you know, around the East Coast tenements and or in some of the, you know, the impoverished labor. You know, camps, farm camps, you know, enough labor camps of industries that moved out to the Great Plains. But we don't really know a whole lot about the people otherwise. So this is quite a wonderful new study for us. But, and the details of what they ate, you know, in the past 100 years, very unusual to see anything whatsoever. So where did your information come from primarily?
Well, this is exactly the period when the science of nutrition was born. And it was a period in which scientists, particularly in Germany, began to look at the chemical contents of food and what happened to them when people ate them. A chemist, and these early nutritionists were chemists, a chemist in the United States by the name of W.O. Atwater went to Germany. He saw what was happening there, and he carried the interest back, and he founded a group of disciples, other chemists who got interested in the mission. And they, under the auspices of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, began to survey parts of the United States, the question being, did people of all stripes, occupations and races and ethnic groups, require the same nutrients? And that's how they launched their investigation on ordinary people.
Interesting. I mean, prior to that, you say that the study of nutrition was such a national science. I mean, before that, people weren't even aware of what a calorie was. I mean, it wasn't named, right? I mean,
exactly. There were no calories or fats or carbohydrates, and even in the period that I'm covering, vitamins and minerals remain terra incognito. So, we're talking about a developing science and some basic questions that took these guys and women out of their labs and into ordinary homes.
Now, how was this information collected? I mean, they actually—you say out of the labs and into homes. So they traveled about and interviewed these people.
They did, often getting help from what in those days were called settlement houses, or what we'd call welfare agencies today. People on the ground who knew, for example, some of the neighborhoods that they. They barely knew, and the typical approach was to visit a household, daily, perhaps twice a day, and actually count and weigh the foods that the family either brought in from the garden or home from the grocery store. So it was very, very precise. There wasn't any survey data in these times. It was count and weigh.
Yeah, right. Well, so to what extent did that work really reflect the actual practices of the people? I mean, obviously, if they're looking at the food that's in the pantry or on the table, I would imagine that was a pretty good reflection of what they were eating.
It was. This window through the work of nutritionists gives us a little bit different view than we're used to in culinary history, because we're looking at what's coming into the kitchen rather than what's being prepared there and going out to the table.
Right.
So it's a different kind of perspective that gives us an understanding of similarities and differences between people in different regions, different classes, different income groups, and so forth.
All right. And I think that the field and studies of culinary history now have gotten some recognition. Before, it was not even recognized as a scholarly endeavor, but now has gotten more recognition. But nutritional anthropology was, for many years, for those of us way back when, was one of the only ways we could actually look at, study what people were actually eating. So it's interesting now that I feel the lines have blurred a little bit in those two faculties. Not really a dichotomy between, you know, the nutritional science and culinary history. But yes, I understand what you're saying, that indeed, especially for those days, it was something that was groundbreaking.
Mm-hmm. It was. And when I first started, I first started doing nutritional anthropology in the 1980s. And there was a good deal of interest in anthropology, but people in other disciplines kind of scratched their heads when we said we were interested in food.
Food, right. Food. That's not, you know, that's not something to study, right? Well, all right. Okay, so the big $60,000 question, you know, what were some of the results? What did you find out about a lot of the, and we're talking, you focus primarily on those of lesser means, the ones who were really, because it was the 1%, and then there was pretty much a large impoverished group of people, right?
Exactly. The focus in the book is largely on working class people, and both in cities and in the country. That was the focus, of course, of United States Department of Agriculture and the government, because these people were the problem. They're coming in from abroad. What are their eating habits? How do we best Americanize them? It wasn't the upper class that was the issue. And so there's a great deal of data on the people in of lesser means, and it's interesting to contrast them with the upper and middle classes, and we have a little bit of contrastive information there.
Mm. Were they finding that there were lack of nutrition that were causing particular diseases or deaths with, you know, throughout these groups of people?
Well, very, very good question. In these days, the late 19th century, nutrition studies were unaccompanied by medical studies. And so there's only anecdotal observations regarding the medical condition of the households and the communities being studied. However, when you take this information that was collected and carefully analyze it, you get some pretty interesting contrast, say, between the middle class and unskilled laborers in the lower class. For example, one of the most telling is the variety of foods that during any season any particular household might consume. And for the middle and upper classes, for a two-week period, which was the typical period of investigation in those days for a household, a two-week period, an upper or middle-class house might consume 40, 50, 60 different foods during that period of time. A working-class, unskilled laborer's household might consume 10 or less on a cotton tenant farmer's plantation, a cotton plantation in the South. It might be 4 or 5 foods over 2 weeks.
Wow. I would imagine.
Not much variety.
Yeah, I would imagine. And as you say, those who had access to a patch of ground, I mean, they could at least plant a garden and have some fresh vegetables. But otherwise.
Unfortunately, that's only in some seasons.
That's right.
And when you're an African-American tenant farmer, no, you really didn't have much time to plant a patch of ground and grow much food. So it was almost all purchased from the company store.
Company store, right.
And so what's the deal here? 4 or 5 foods, they may be plentiful, but that doesn't cover all the bases nutritionally. We don't know exactly what the vitamin or mineral intake may have been, but to have comparatively 50 or 60 types of food over 2 weeks, you have greater surety that all of the your nutritional needs are being covered. Not so with the underclasses.
All right. I would imagine that the one lacking category would be proteins of any kind.
Protein was a big problem. A typical working man of, say, middling stature required 3,500 calories a day in, say, 1880 or 1890, which seems like a heck of a lot to us today, but remember, there was no central heating, and every place you had to go basically on foot, and there weren't so many machines doing our work. It was mostly with muscle, so it required a good deal of calories, and it was stressful work, which would tear down muscle and require constant rebuilding of both muscle and bone, and so protein was required as well, often in short supply because of the poverty.
Right. So, what was making up in well, let's say we have to pick a group because I'm sure the diets were very different depending on one group to another. But pick a group and tell us what made up the bulk of their diet.
Okay, that's a good question. The book starts off with New Mexico and the native Mexican Americans. This is before New Mexico became a state, which mm-hmm. I think happened around 1910 or so. I'm not exactly certain.
Mm-hmm.
But the diet for the typical Mexican-American ranch hand near Las Cruces, New Mexico, consisted of wheat flour, interestingly. Not cornmeal at the core of it. Beans, lard, sugar, potatoes, and chiles. That's the staples. Those are the foods at least found in 50% of the households looked at, or at least something that would be in the majority of the households. About a quarter of the time, cornmeal was found, as well as eggs. Hmm. And that was about it. Occasionally some rice, some fideos, the pasta, some peas, onions, and maybe some stick candy for the kids. But that's a pretty meager diet for people in the Southwest. In town, it might be a little bit more, but out on the ranches amongst the poor, not much.
Right. I just got this image in my head. The only thing that that I was relating to it that you know that I could think of was a study of the yeoman's diet back in in the early periods in England, and similar thing. I mean, eating gruel. They always talk about the gruel. They had every day. They had gruel. Is this more or less what we're looking at? There was a grain type carbohydrate derived food that people were subsisting on.
Very, very heavily, and the supplemented in certain places. Again, as you pointed out, we don't have a national diet at this point or a national food system. Mm-hmm. It's regional and it's by ethnic ethnic group and occupational group. But it was basically a grain diet, either corn or wheat. Supplemented by pork fat in terms of caloric content. That would be bacon and lard. And again, there were no vegetable oils at this time. So we're talking mainly table and cooking fats are animal derived.
Mm-hmm.
So an amazing paucity of vegetables, I might add, in virtually all of these, except for upper-class diets. At this time, vegetables weren't available all year. There wasn't a great deal of canning or preservation. Such things were a bit expensive. There were canned foods in stores, but they were quite expensive. And so that end of the diet was largely neglected, except during growing season.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, that is very interesting. And my question about the vegetables: were even the upper class consuming a lot of vegetables?
Were they consuming
a
lot of vegetables?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me a lot. They were okay. So there was
they were, and particularly women. One of the opportunities I got it, and as an anthropologist, I'm an inveterate compare and contrast guy. I like to look at different groups and different classes of people and see how they're alike and how they're different. And conveniently, during this period, in universities and colleges, which were strictly upper class at this period of time, men and women ate separately in different dining halls. Well, what a great opportunity to compare and contrast. And we find during the period that women are the major consumer of vegetables. I have here, I'm looking at a page here in my book now of data from Western Reserve University. 2-week period, men's dormitory, 14 vegetables consumed. Women's dormitory, 47 vegetables consumed. And that's not counting grains and dried legumes. So a remarkable difference in vegetable consumption. You look at a working class household in Pittsburgh, not too far from Cleveland. 3 vegetables over the course of 2 weeks.
Hmm.
So, between men and women, between classes, some very, very interesting contrasts.
All right. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of those classes and some of the people you didn't look at when we come back after a short break.
Itoen, the leading green tea company and makers of Oiocha, Japan's number one selling green tea, offers an array of award-winning ready-to-drink teas, premium tea leaves, tea bags, and antioxidant matcha powder. From the refreshing taste of Tea's Tea, brewed with only the purest of teas, to Matcha Love, taking a modern take on an ancient ritual, Itoen celebrates the authentic tastes of Japan with their 50-plus years of tea-making expertise. For a natural energy boost, try Sencha Shot, packed with healthy catechins and vitamin C. Do visit the Matcha Love store in the Mitsuo Marketplace located in Edgewater, New Jersey, for their signature matcha ice cream and shakes. Hoji and black sesame are also a must. With a selection of delicious teas, teaware, and gift sets, Matcha Love by Itoen is not to be missed. For more information, visit itoen.com.
Hi, I'm talking with Robert Dirks, professor emeritus from Illinois State University, an anthropologist. And he has taken the late 19th century's early science of nutrition and studied the data from the turn of the century, early 19th century through the end, and given us a wonderful new book and study on what ordinary people ate during the Gilded Age. It's called Food of the Gilded Age, What Ordinary Americans Ate. And Robert, when you decided certain groups to look at to study what they ate, there's some that are conspicuously missing. And I want to know why you chose not to, such as urban factory workers or Midwestern farmers. Why did you not include them?
Well, they're not included, quite frankly, because the early nutritionists who were conducting the studies from which I drew my data did not include them.
Good reason.
So we basically have nothing comparable for many, many groups in the United States. But we count ourselves very, very lucky to have what we have. For example, for African Americans, we have several communities that give us an entire range from the Deep South, Tuskegee, Alabama, home of the Tuskegee Institute, and right in the middle of the Cotton Belt, on up through the Tidewater, Virginia, three communities of African Americans in that area, through Washington, D.C., into Philadelphia, finally on to Cheney, Pennsylvania, and New York City. So a wonderful, I guess you would call it, rural-urban continuum. Mm-hmm. And we have something quite similar for Appalachia and Chicago in terms of classes from unskilled to professionals. So we have these things, and we're very, very lucky to. And this is a real game changer in studying when nutrition science gets into the business. We have a whole different outlook on history.
All right. What were some of the conclusions that you drew from some of the groups of people? The poverty line group of people, manual laborers. What any interesting or specific conclusions that you drew from your studies?
Well, one of the very striking things that I wasn't prepared for, I'm not sure anyone is or was, because the understanding is that while people during certain times of the year, such as the winter, might have to tighten their belt a little bit. I wasn't prepared for the extent of that belt tightening and how the poor were lacking and deficient in their diet during the this is the urban poor of the North during winter time.
Mm-hmm.
If you chart intake of any of the macronutrients we're looking at, it's a roller coaster. with the bottom of the roller coaster, late winter and early spring, going up to the top during late summer and early fall during the harvest season. And for the South, a little bit different. There too, amongst the poor people, a roller coaster in terms of protein intake, with the low point in spring and early summer, and the high point in fall and early winter. Mm-hmm. And this had throughout the United States a profound effect, because I hearken back to reading some economic history a decade or so back, and there was a remarkable difference in stature in the late 19th century between people, or amongst people of different classes, such that those who were of the ownership or managerial classes might be 2 inches taller than those who were from the manual working class. Well, not hard to figure out how that happened.
Right.
When you have these literal hunger periods once a year affecting children, and this affected their growth because with insufficient calories during midwinter, whatever protein you would have available for tissue growth would be shunted over to simply heat the body, or fuel the body. And so you get a growth arrest, which is never made up. Mm-hmm. So I was able to connect some dots here and see how this occurred. It wasn't through some perpetual hunger state, but it was due to seasonal fluctuations, which the wealthy managed to bridge by simply eating more meat, more fatty bacons and such like that, and making up the calories.
Right. And of course, certain, around this time, well, in the late 19th century, just about the time when grocery stores were coming into being. I mean, so there, you know, accessibility to food was difficult for many people too, I would imagine. Well, you should say, particularly those periods of time.
I think during this period of time, for example, if we talk about the tenement areas of New York that were studied by nutritionists, I'm talking about New York City, most of the grocery shopping was done day by day, in fact, even meal by meal, at small shops on the block. So I think the interesting thing about this business of history, and even at a range of 100, 125 years, is the cultural difference that you encounter. You didn't have homes stocked with food, particularly amongst the poor who had no way to refrigerate it or store it.
Right.
It was sort of store to mouth.
Right. The food chain, talk about when it comes to refrigeration. Right.
Exactly.
It was important.
And the for people in the Deep South, it was a long chain. I was prepared to see their consumption of pork being local, but I'm sitting here in Chicago, not too terribly far from what was the site of the great stockyards. Chicago was feeding the blacks in Alabama with its cured pork products.
Hmm, interesting. It is indeed an interesting study, and I'm glad you put a lot of this together, because it's, again, as I say, an area of our history that no one likes to read about, the bad stuff, the poverty, but it's so important to know what you know, how people were getting by, how they were living, and how we can change things. Of course, we love to read about the glitter and the gold and the glitz, and that will go on. That will always be there. But today we still have our problems with nutrition, with eating proper foods, with eating healthfully, but we have so much more information now. And I thank you for bringing this nutritional science, the new science, as you call it, you know, to light. And it's something for us to realize what a short time it was. It was a little over 100 years. And
that's right.
And how little we knew, right?
Right.
Well, I encourage people who are interested in this topic to take a look. It's Food in the Gilded Age, What Ordinary Americans Ate. And Robert Dirks, thank you very much for joining me today and for sharing this information. It has really been an eye-opener.
And thank you, Linda, for this opportunity to talk about it.
Okay. And thank you for listening to all my listeners out there. It's been a taste of the past. And join me again here on Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.